Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast.
Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 147 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastering. Not only do I pass along any knowledge I've gained over 25 plus years of running RPGs, I also share wisdom from guest GMs and listener GMs like you. Today, I discuss D&D Beyond, a new online tool for players and DMs. I also discuss how cutting words interacts with initiative rolls, a few initiative variants, and using potions. Finally, I give an update on my upcoming D&D adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth. So we got quite a few topics that we're covering today, and I'll be referencing some previous episodes of the show, as well as various other resources and places to visit online. So you can find links to all the things I discussed today in the show notes over at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney/147. I want to give a quick thank you and shout out to new patron of Starwalker Studios, Mr. Pete Avila. Thank you so much for becoming a patron of the show, Pete. Really appreciate it. Still working on my upcoming D&D adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth, which will be available on starwalkerstudios.com. I've had some people ask me if it's going to be on the DMs Guild. No, it's not. It's going to be on my website, starwalkerstudios.com. And I've got the page up already. It's actually starwalkerstudios.com/tricky. And I got a little post there, and I have the cover art up, which Nikki finished earlier this week. And so you can check out the cover art. Super cool. I also posted it in the Game Master's Journey community, so you can check it out there. And I'll probably be making some more posts on that page of the website going forward, just giving some updates in the production and all that good stuff. Nikki's working on the layout right now, and I believe she's finished chapter 2. So she's trucking right along. So I think it will be out sooner rather than later. I mean, once she's got the layout done, it's pretty much done. And it will be up for everyone to enjoy. So I'm super excited. And thank you, Nikki, for the awesome cover art. Oh my God, it's fantastic. Can't wait for you to see it and let me know what you think. For those of you who don't pay attention to Wizards of the Coast Online, they have announced the upcoming release of a new service called D&D Beyond. So this is going to be something that you can use online in a web browser, and also I believe is going to be an app that you can use on Android or iPhone, and they have started beta testing it, and everyone is welcome to join the beta. So you can go to dndbeyond.com or just head to the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com, and I'll have a link there. You can sign up and check it out. There are going to be 3 phases to the beta as they bring out more features. So in phase 1, which is what has been released as of recording this, we have the compendium, which has all the information from the SRD, the system resource document, in it. You can look up spells, you can look up magic items, you can look up monsters, all kinds of great stuff. And you know, there are various places where you can browse the SRD. There's the actual PDF itself. There are websites that have compiled the information, but this is, to me, hands down, the best way to browse the SRD that I've found. It's very user-friendly. You can search. For instance, I'm looking at the monsters right now. I can search by a monster name. I can search by minimum or maximum challenge rating. I can search by size, tiny to gargantuan. I can search by environment, aquatic, forest, etc. So this is going to be super useful For instance, you know, if I'm making an adventure and I want to come up with an encounter, I can look for, let's do it here. So let's say my group is level 3. So I want to look for monsters with a minimum CR of 1/8 and let's say a maximum CR of, let's say 5. I don't care about the size, but I'm looking for forest encounters. So I'm going to select forest and I'm going to filter, see what we get. All right, here we go. I've got a 4-page list of monsters I could use. Let's see, we've got the Ankheg, ape, awakened tree, black bear. They're alphabetical. However, this is in a table format. I can sort by name, which is the default. It's sorted alphabetically. I can reverse sort. So I click name. Oh, that didn't work. Let's try it again. There we go. And now we're starting with the end of the alphabet. So I've got warg, wolf, were-tiger, were-rat, were-boar. I could sort by CR. So first time I click that is going to go small to low. So we're starting with the 8th CRs, or I could click it again and start with my CR5s. We've got gorgon, shambling mound, troll, unicorn. I can sort by type. For instance, monstrosity, plant, giant. I can sort by size. I can sort by alignment, or I can sort by environment, which of course right now isn't going to do anything because environment was one of my limiting factors. I can also sort by tags, which are things like shape changer, miscellaneous creature. That's not a very good tag. Let's see what other tags we're seeing here just in the search I did. Goblinoid. So yeah, this is super sweet. This right here, I am definitely going to be using this when I prepare for sessions, because this is so much easier than flipping through the monster manual, especially if I'm looking for, you know, like this exercise I just did is something I would totally do. I want certain environments, I want certain CRs, and there you go, boom, I can see it. And also at the top of the screen, I'm looking at the monster section of the compendium right now. They have the different monster types. So we've got Fae, Elemental, Dragon. They got a cool graphic for each one. You can click on and see those. So that's the monsters. We've got items. Let's check out the items. And again, we have different categories. We can look at armor, artifact, potion, ring, rod, scroll, staff, wand, etc. Has the same kind of search functionality. So I can type in an item name and find something that way. I can search by rarity. Whether or not it requires attunement, tags like movement, utility, things like that, magic bonus, +1, +2, or +3. And I can filter using as few or as many of those tags as I want. My results, I can sort by name, type, whether or not it requires attunement. And then there is a notes field. This is super cool. Going to be super useful. We've got spells. I'll look at the spells tab here. Same kind of thing. So I can, at the top, I have the different spellcasters. So I could look just at wizard spells or just at druid spells. I can search and filter spells. So I can look at spell name, spell level, spell tags, healing utility, things like that, casting time, and filter by all those things. And then my results, I can sort by level, name, casting time, duration, range or area, whether it's an attack roll or what kind of save it uses, and the damage or effect, damage effect and attack save I can't sort by, which makes sense. But those are values that are listed in this table. So this is crazy cool. Let's see, what's compendium? Yeah, compendium is just kind of a table of contents. And, you know, this is going to have everything from the SRD, everything from the basic rules in it. So, for instance, we have a section here, and it looks like this is, some of these correspond to chapters in the Player's Handbook. Some of them don't. But we have using ability scores, which is a chapter in the Player's Handbook that we talked about on the show. And here I can see more information on ability checks and saves, ability scores, and then the scores. So this is going to be super useful during play, because a lot of times, for instance, just the other day, I was running Curse of Strahd for my home group. And one of the characters wanted to know how much they could lift. And I knew that that was a thing based on their strength score, but I had to flip through the book and find that. If I would have had my laptop or my phone with the app handy, go right here to the compendium under using ability scores, I could just click strength, which I'm going to do. And here's all the strength information. I scroll down to lifting and carrying. Carrying capacity is your strength score multiplied by 15. I just found that right now in real time. It took me what, like less than 5 seconds? I guarantee you it took me a lot longer than 5 seconds to find that in the player's handbook. Even though I knew exactly what chapter it was in, I knew exactly, well, not exactly, I guess that would be the page number, right? But I knew very closely where in the book to find it. I didn't even have to figure out where to find it in the book, partly because I just did my series of episodes on the player's handbook. So it's all really fresh in my mind where everything is. But even so, it still took me probably a minute, maybe a little longer, to find it in the book. And this is so much faster. This is awesome. Also, forums. So everyone who was lamenting the end of Wizards of the Coast's official forums are back. And this is very extensive forums already at the top. And you definitely want to scroll through this because there's a lot more than you see above the fold. At the top is a D&D Beyond forums, which is what this online tool is called, D&D Beyond. So that's all stuff to do with D&D Beyond. But you go past that, and then we have Dungeons & Dragons discussion. So we've got sub-forums under that. We've got tips and tactics, rules and game mechanics, D&D Adventurers League, Dungeon Masters Guild, Unearthed Arcana, and Homebrew and House Rules. Then we have class forums. So there's a sub-forum for each of the classes in the game. And then we've got the off-topic forum for people that just need to be off-topic. So I hope that this will not reduce people's usage of the Game Master's Journey community. But this is great to have the official forums back. This is really awesome. So again, this is just phase one of the launch of the beta. I'm not seeing right here if we know an ETA for phase two and phase three. So phase one, we have the compendium, listings, and forums. So, and this part of it, my understanding is, and this is still, you know, we're still learning about this, but my understanding is that this part, what we're seeing in phase one, is going to be free. So even when this is out of beta, even when it's the final thing is launched, what I'm talking about here today, looking up spells, magic items, monsters, and using the forums is all going to be free. You can do that for free. There are going to be more premium features that are going to require probably some kind of monthly subscription, but all the SRD stuff is free. And honestly, you know, this is what I'm going to be using is this free stuff. This is what I'm most excited about, and it's not going to cost me anything. So there's been a lot of negativity online, as there always is about anything, it seems like. There's been a lot of negativity online since this was announced, and you know, a lot of Chicken Littles running around screaming the sky is falling, and a lot of people with very little information to go on making a lot of negative assumptions and all that. So it's always good to wait until you actually know what you're talking about before you get too emotional about things. And, you know, just with what we have here in the beta and the SRD access stuff, which is all the stuff I've been talking about, which is going to be free, is super cool and going to be super useful, not only for DMs preparing for sessions, but also during play at the table, and also useful to players because it's going to be a lot easier if you have this app on your phone, for instance, to look up a spell or whatever on this than it is going to be on your player's handbook. And let's face it, you know, your phone is a lot lighter than one of those books, definitely a lot lighter than all three. So speaking of which, let's look at a monster. I didn't actually go into a monster. Let's look at the adult gold dragon here. Yep, everything's here, all the stats, everything. We've got, and it's all very nicely laid out, easy to see everything, saves, actions, legendary actions, it's all here. So even as a dungeon master running the game, you could use this instead of the monster manual and not have to lug the monster manual around. So this is super cool. Now, one thing I'm curious about is not everything in the game is in the SRD. So for instance, the monsters, not all the monsters are in the SRD. So I'm curious if they're all in here, but just by what I've seen, just fiddling around with it, it seems like maybe they all are, because it seems like I'm seeing a lot more monsters in the search results than what are in the SRD. So if any of you have gone through this and looked and seen if there are things in here that aren't in the SRD, shoot me an email, gamemastersjourney@gmail.com, or tweet to me, or shoot me a message on Google Plus and let me know if you've gone through it and tried to figure that out. All right, so this is all phase one. This is all going to be free. It is free right now, and anyone can do the beta. It's not a limited beta. Anybody can go use this. Only downside I've seen so far is you have to use a Twitch ID to log in, which only makes sense because Curse, the company that's developing this, is the same company behind Twitch. So I guess that makes sense, but it doesn't really make sense because there's not very much overlap between D&D Beyond and Twitch. Now, of course, there are some people who play D&D and stream D&D online and use Twitch to do that. And for those handful of people, this is going to be super convenient because they don't have to create a new logon. They can just use their Twitch. But, you know, by far the majority of D&D players that are going to be looking at an online tool are not using Twitch, whether that's as a streamer or just watching things on Twitch. So to have to go create a logon on a completely unrelated service to use this is annoying. I'm hoping that when this is officially launched or even before then, they're going to have where you can create just your own account on D&D Beyond. And it could be just a thing of prioritizing. And they're like, you know, let's get this out sooner and let people play with it and get feedback. Even though we haven't worked out the, you know, creating an account on D&D Beyond. So we're just going to use Twitch because we've already got the back end for that set up. But in the future, you know, we're going to have our own, where you can have your own account on D&D Beyond. I would hope that that's the case, but I don't know. And there is a, on the forum here, there is a feedback for beta testing and feedback sub forum. And there is already a thread of people complaining about needing the Twitch logon. And I posted my opinion in that. And I also tweeted at D&D Beyond and got no response, which makes me wonder, because I would think that if it was what I said and it's something, you know, where they are going to have their own logon system, but they are just using Twitch as kind of a placeholder right now so they could get it out sooner for people to beta test, I would think that they would tell people that. So the fact that they haven't, or at least to my knowledge, they haven't, kind of makes me wonder. Let me find that thread. I haven't looked at it in a couple days and see if anyone from the team has responded. Here we go. Oh my God, there's 10 pages. All right, so we do have a response from 2 days ago on the forum from Molster, who is D&D Beyond staff, who says, "We at Curse are a part of Twitch. All of our sites going forward are using Twitch logins as we start letting people merge their Curse accounts into Twitch." So, you know, I'll see if there's anything more recent than that, but that's really unfortunate. And, you know, they're just trying to force you to use Twitch. Which is pretty lame, but what are you going to do? I mean, for me, it's not I already have a Twitch account because I used to stream on Twitch before YouTube gaming came out. So I have a Twitch account. So it wasn't a huge deal for me. I just found it annoying. But if I was someone who didn't already have a Twitch account and I had to go to this other service that I'm not going to use to make an account to log into D&D Beyond, I'd be quite a bit annoyed. And it's not even a disguised attempt to try to get you to use Twitch, right? I mean, that's the whole point. So I don't think that's cool. Well, that, and they, you know, it's just a little less development that they need to do with this because they've already got a Twitch system for tracking accounts and all that stuff. But D&D Beyond should be separate. Come on, guys. Just scrolling through here to see if there's any more responses. Doesn't look like it. Just lots of people complaining about it. So maybe they'll listen. Here's another post from Bad Eye, another member of the staff, who says, "We appreciate the feedback here and definitely, quote, hear you. Please remember this is the first phase of the beta." So it doesn't seem like this is carved in stone. So if you have an opinion about this, maybe go to the forum. Of course, you're going to have to make a Twitch account to use the forum, but maybe go on the forum and let them know. I think if enough people complain, they'll do something about it. I mean, this is beta, and that's part of beta is to get, you know, people's opinions on things while you still have time to change things. So definitely let them know. Just a few more pages here I'm scrolling through. Luckily, people from the team, their username is Red, so it makes it easy to find the official posts. Oh my God, people on the internet are so annoying. All these people with off-topic crap and writing novellas. It's like people really don't understand how that really decreases the chance of us all getting what we want when you have people just crapping up a thread. That's why I don't pay much attention to forums anymore. I love the Game Master's Journey community, man. We don't have any of that BS there. It's so great. And normally I would say because I moderate it and I'm not afraid to swing the ban hammer, but honestly, I almost never have to moderate the Game Master's Journey community. Really, the only people I've ever had to remove from the community were just spam accounts, just people who join the community to spam and don't contribute anything. I've never had to remove someone or even talk to someone about, you know, being rude or being immature or inappropriate or anything like that, which is amazing. You know, I'm a member of numerous Facebook groups and Google Plus communities, and I kind of lurk a little bit on the EN World forums. And I have not found another RPG community that's near as nice as ours as far as, you know, people staying on topic and not being children. So yeah, kudos to all of you in the community. I really appreciate everybody being respectful adults. All right, so phase two of the D&D Beyond beta is going to have a character builder and character sheet. And what the team behind D&D Beyond have said so far is for free, you will be able to use the tools with, you know, a few characters, like maybe one or two or three characters. And then if you want to manage more characters, then you'll have to pay for the premium. So, you know, in addition to all this SRD stuff, you're also going to get to be able to track at least one or two characters for free, which is pretty sweet. And then phase three is going to be homebrew integration and campaign management. And those are two things I'm pretty sure are going to require the subscription for. So, you know, if you're wanting to bring in homebrew stuff, or if you're wanting to manage your campaign using D&D Beyond, then that's something that you're going to have to pay for. But, you know, there are other things out there like that, like Realmworks, you know, and they're not free either. So I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, having to pay for some of this stuff. And I think that what they are going to offer for free is going to be the bulk of what especially players are going to want and need. I think for the most part, the premium services will be more in the realm of the DM, unless you're a player that plays in a lot of campaigns and you got a lot of characters. But I think for your average player, the free version will be everything you need. And I think even for a lot of DMs, the free version will be everything that you need or want. Like, I know for me personally, you know, I already have ways of managing my campaign. I use OneNote. So I'm going to mainly just use this as a very quick rules reference and also, you know, something I can have on the road in just my phone, and I don't have to carry all these books around. And those things are going to be available for free. So this is super awesome. So, you know, a lot of times out there, there's a lot of hype, either good hype or bad hype for things, and things people tend to like to go to one extreme or the other. So, you know, as in all things, you know, be skeptical, make your own decisions, do your own research. And when it comes to D&D Beyond, go check it out for yourself. See what you think of it for yourself. Don't just listen to some YouTuber or blogger who's bagging it when they probably don't even know much what they're talking about. Of course, I haven't seen a lot of negativity since the beta came out. A lot of it was before the beta came out when we didn't even really know what was going on. But there is a thread on EN World where a member of the team was answering a lot of questions, which is where I've gotten a lot of my information from. And I believe there's also a thread on Reddit somewhere where they were answering questions. So for people that really want to be informed, the information is out there. There's really no excuse for running off half-cocked and saying a bunch of negative things and not knowing what you're talking about. But that's just my opinion. All right. So that's D&D Beyond. Check it out. I have a link in the show notes, starwalkerstudios.com. And again, anybody can get in the beta and you can start using it. I mean, it's populated now. I mean, you can use it now, even though it's beta. I haven't messed with it a whole lot. You know, there might be some issues here and there. I don't know. I'm sure there are. It's a beta. But what I've tried to do with it so far, I haven't had any problems. So I'm pretty impressed with it.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
I want to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible.
If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. Patrons get some cool perks like game material I make for Primordia and access to a special monthly podcast I produce just for the patrons. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my Tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
You the man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. So last week in episode 146, I finally completed my delving into the player's handbook. And, you know, we really powered through that. I had more than one 2 hour plus episode just trying to get through that and not have it take all year. And because of that, I haven't shared a lot of feedback on the show lately. So today I wanted to share some feedback I've gotten in recent weeks and things I thought we'd talk about on the show today. So quite a few weeks ago in episode 143, I discussed downtime activities, and I made a comment about bards and how as a bard, you can basically practice a profession of entertaining and spend 8 hours a day doing that, and you get the a certain lifestyle. I think maybe it was wealthy. I don't remember exactly which lifestyle it was, but you get a certain lifestyle for free while you do that. And I just made kind of an offhand comment about how it might actually be hard to perform for 8 hours a day as a bard. And Thomas Chapman left me a voicemail and he's had some thoughts on that. And I think he makes a lot of really great points. So let's hear what Thomas has to say.
Hey Lex, Tom Chapman here. I'm sending you a voice message because I was listening to your episode in the car, and I was especially interested in the downtime activities, but I wanted to give you a quick note because you pointed out that a performer could afford a wealthy lifestyle, but then we started comparing that to professions, such as, I guess, being a blacksmith or crafting something else, or being a brewer even. And you mentioned that that would be quite amazing that someone could play for or perform for 8 hours a day. And I don't think that's quite how that rule could be interpreted. I mean, it definitely could go that way. But another way to think about it is how an actual performer would be. So I'm going to take, for example, a jazz musician, a club musician, or a classical musician, or even an orator in the Middle Ages. What most likely their day would look like is performing-wise, they'd probably only do 2 to 3 hours a day, and that'd most likely be at night. If they're a tavern musician, their job is to bring people into the tavern and entertain them, and they'd get paid by the tavern owner plus tips. Or they could also be a courtly musician or performer and perform for aristocrats and other nobility at their social gatherings, so a storyteller during dinner or a lute player during conversation and things like that. So most likely they'd only be playing for 2 to 3 hours a day. Now most professionals, when it comes to performing, spend a significant amount of their day practicing too. So for example, classical musicians or jazz musicians, while they only play for about 2 or 3 hours a day, they also will spend about 3 to 4 hours practicing. So for a musician, obviously that's with their instrument or coming up with new compositions. For orators and storytellers, it's coming up with those new stories that they're going to perform. So there, even with 2 to 3 hours of performing a day, with that practice, we're already at 5 to 7 hours a day. Now, if we use our modern times as an example, and there's evidence of this in the past, then also performers would probably be using their skills to make even more money on the side by giving private lessons to those that can afford it, especially if we're looking at the level that performers are in Dungeons and Dragons, then those are like the top of their game. People are going to pay good money for that. So I'm going to take my own life as an example. I am both a musician and you could classify me as profession teacher under the rules. So according to what I do per day, I make about $160 a day as a teacher. But if I were to stop that and go full-time music performing, then most likely my day would be spent going around town, fostering contacts, trying to get people to let me in my group or just myself perform for their audience. And then I would spend a significant amount of time also doing private lessons. So after I'm done, you know, practicing on my own and going around and fostering contacts, then I would teach private lessons. And assuming two hours a day to teach lessons, if I was a performer at the level that I didn't need to do anything else but perform, I'd probably be charging at least $30 a half an hour for teaching private lessons. So right there, we got $120 in a day just from teaching private lessons. And then if I perform at night, most likely I'm going to get paid. If I perform for 2 hours, you know, low end would probably be around $50. Plus, if I'm at a tavern or even performing for a courtly situation, I'd probably get fed. It might not be great, but I would get fed, and I'd probably get a pretty good beverage or five out of it too. So once we take that into account, really, $240 a day as a professional musician wouldn't be unheard of if you're using that time to teach private lessons and fostering other contacts. So all this is just a way around saying, even though it is unrealistic that someone would perform in any medium for 8 hours a day, there's a lot that goes into the performance aspect. And so if you've got a bard trying to figure out how to fill up their time going, well, I guess I'll go yodel for 8 hours at a tavern. Well, no one's going to want to listen to anybody sing for 8 hours at the same tavern, and you'd wear out your welcome pretty quick in that town. So just in a performer's life, there's a lot that goes into that and something to take into account and to consider, especially when comparing it with other professions. So, hey, Lex, thanks for the great show. I really appreciate it. And thanks for taking the time to listen to this. Have a great night.
Thank you so much for calling in and sharing those thoughts with us, Thomas. I completely agree, and you made a lot of good points, and I hadn't thought of all that. Podcasting, man, you know, you're kind of on the spot, and I'm always later like, oh, I should have said this, or I forgot that, or I screwed that up. So really appreciate you calling in and sharing some of your real-world experience that we can apply to our games. And yeah, I mean, totally makes sense, and I think, you know, that's a great way if you're playing a bard as a player, or if you're the DM and you have a bard in the party, that's a really great way you can really kind of pull in their bard profession during downtime and even, you know, develop some story elements with it or introduce some side plots or just bring more verisimilitude into your game. Speaking of bards, Kyle Madriga had a question about the bard ability cutting words. He says, in combat, lore bards can use their cutting words feature to decrease an ability check of an enemy. I've always ruled that initiative is an ability check, so they can decrease the initiative of an enemy using their first turn's reaction if they are not surprised, but I haven't seen anyone outside my table use this feature. I'd really love for it to be more widely used. Assuming I'm right and you haven't already, could you mention it on an episode? Yeah, absolutely. So you are 100% correct. An initiative roll is a dexterity ability check. So anything in the game that can influence an ability check can influence an initiative roll because it's a dexterity ability check. And it's really that simple. So if we look at the cutting words ability, it says when a creature that you can see within 60 feet of you makes an attack roll, an ability check, or a damage roll, you can use your reaction to use one of your bardic inspirations and do your cutting words thing. So I think everything Kyle is talking about here is right down the line, rules as written. Initiative is a dexterity ability check, and you use your reaction to use cutting words, and you can reduce an opponent's initiative. And, you know, I don't think I've ever seen a player do that. And that's a brilliant use of cutting words. Now, the only kind of side note I would make is because the player is using their reaction to do that, if it's a situation where the player character is surprised, then they wouldn't be able to use their cutting words. Because when we talked about the surprised condition, I don't know that it's not technically a condition, but when you're surprised, you don't get to use reactions until after your first turn in that combat or whatever. So in the instance where you as a DM had people make a check for surprise, if the bard is surprised, then they wouldn't be able to use the cutting words. But if they're not surprised, yeah, you can totally use cutting words on an opponent's initiative. And speaking of that, Kyle kind of reminded me of something that I wanted to mention during the show when I was talking about the combat rules that I forgot to mention. And, you know, like I said, when you're doing a podcast, there's so many times that just because you're talking on the spot, you either say something wrong or you forget something or whatever. So one point that I wanted to make when I was talking about the death saving throw is if you have a magic item or something that gives you a bonus to all saving throws, that does apply to death saving throws. So unlike the other saving throws based on the six abilities in the game, strength, dex, etc., the death saving throw, you don't normally get any bonuses. You don't get an ability score bonus to it. You don't get your proficiency bonus to it. It's just you roll a d20, and if you roll 10 or higher, you succeed. If you roll 9 or lower, you fail, and it's just that simple. But if you have something like, say, a cloak of protection or a ring of protection, which both of those items give you a +1 bonus to all saving throws, then those will apply to death saving throws because they are saving throws. So that's just a point I wanted to make, and I forgot to make it. And speaking of, while I'm talking about that kind of stuff, in episode 146, towards the end of the episode, and you'll remember that was a super long episode, marathon episode, I was talking about the classifications of arcane versus divine spellcasting. And I mentioned something about them not mentioning the warlock in there, and they actually did. And I even read it to you, which is what makes it hilarious. And they listed the warlock as an arcane caster. I caught that when I was doing the final edit, but I just left it in because I thought it was kind of funny. And I thought it was so obvious that anyone who was at all paying attention would realize my mistake. So I didn't go back and try to fix that. But I thought I would mention it now because I have had a few people point that out. I thought it was kind of almost like an Easter egg. It's like, who's paying attention enough to realize that little blunder I made? So yeah, they do classify the warlock as arcane magic. But, you know, I think the warlock still is a perfect example of how that distinction between arcane and divine magic has really broken down over more recent editions, because, you know, the warlock is getting their magic from a patron, which, you know, they're getting it from an outside source, which sure sounds a lot like the definition of divine magic that they make, right? And they make this, you know, this kind of addendum or this amendment to say, well, a paladin who just follows an oath and doesn't follow a deity, it's still a divine caster. And to me, it would seem like less of an amendment to include a warlock as a divine caster because they're receiving their magic from a patron than it does a paladin who doesn't follow a deity or a patron or anything like that at all. So, you know, I mean, it makes sense to me why the warlock is an arcane caster, but it's more because of the spells that they use than it is because of how they get their magic. When you think about how they get their magic, they seem more like a divine caster than an arcane caster. So it's kind of a mess at this point, and I think that's part of the reason that the whole distinction between arcane and divine got stuck into a sidebar about the Weave, which itself is a thing specific to Forgotten Realms. So it's very kind of on the periphery now, kind of like alignment. I'd say it's even more on the periphery than alignment is now. And probably if or when there is a sixth edition of D&D, I would guess that we won't even see that distinction anymore, unless they try to redesign the game in such a way that that distinction makes sense again. But I kind of doubt that'd be taking quite a few steps back, I think. So I think in the future, we just won't probably see that distinction anymore. So thank you so much, Kyle, for writing in about that and for pointing out that awesome use for cutting words. I'm a huge fan of the Bard in D&D, and even more so after, you know, finishing up the series of episodes on the Player's Handbook and realizing that actually in 5th edition, the Bard is a much better healer than the Druid is. Just based on my experience from previous editions and just kind of assumptions I make and kind of the whole idea of divine versus arcane casters and the fact that the Bard is considered an arcane caster, I just assumed that the Druid was the better healer. But when I was actually looking at the spell list while I was doing the episodes, I realized, well, the Bard is getting more resurrection type spells than the Druid is, and better ones. You know, they get raised dead instead of reincarnation, which reincarnation is not as good as raised dead because A, you come back as something else, and B, it costs twice as much gold to cast as raised dead. So that's really interesting. You know, not only is the Bard a full caster in 5th edition, which I don't think have seen before. They've always been kind of more almost like a half caster or a three-quarter caster. So not only are they full caster, they've got ninth level spells, but they're also a better healer for a party than a druid is. It's really interesting. Of course, a cleric is still the best healer because they get revivify at third level. They're the only class that gets revivify at third level. Paladins do, I believe, get revivify, or I'm sorry, clerics get revivify at fifth level. It's a third level spell. They get it at fifth level. Paladins get revivify, but because they are only a half caster, they don't get it until, I think, is it ninth level? Higher than fifth level. So they get it a lot later than clerics do. So, you know, clerics are still the best healers in the game from that perspective. And the life cleric is the best cleric healer because they get all kinds of bonuses to healing because of their life domain. So that's cool. But I did a whole bunch of episodes on the cleric, so let's not go too far down that rabbit hole. Andrew McLaren also wrote in and says, in episode 145, Lex spoke about using passive perception so that the players are not asked to make a roll, which gives away the fact that something is there to be perceived. Instead, you should make a stealth check for the bad guys and compare the result against everyone's passive perception. The DC for your stealth check is a passive perception of the enemy or the party in this instance, or maybe a more precise way to say it, it's the passive perception of the PC with the highest passive perception, because presumably if one of the characters notices, they're going to tell the other ones, but not always. So Andrew goes on to say, I had the idea of using passive insight in the same way. Yeah, totally. Absolutely. My players will frequently be talking to an NPC and will say, I want to insight check him. Then they roll, and then I have to roll deception. And because suddenly there are five players all rolling insight, the odds are that one of them rolls an 18 or above. I realize you could create a passive insight score for each PC, and then this becomes your DC for a deception check. Less dice rolling. Thoughts, comments? Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And the other thing, you know, I'm sure you were thinking this, but that you didn't state in the email, is also the players know what they roll on that insight check, right? And, you know, yeah, you're absolutely right. If you've got four or five players, even if the DC is 15 or 18 or 20, odds are fairly good, especially if more than one of them have a decent insight bonus, that one of them is going to roll higher than that, right? And it only takes one character to beat that deception check to say, oh, hey, I know he's lying, and I tell everyone else he's lying, right? So that is absolutely true. But what happens even more often than that is that the players roll poorly, and they know they rolled poorly. So even though, you know, they roll a five and you say, yeah, you think they're telling the truth, you know, the player's thinking, well, I don't really know that he's telling the truth because I didn't roll well on my insight. So it could be that he's lying and I just don't realize it. And yeah, you know, a good player will try to separate player knowledge from character knowledge, and they'll try to role play their character as, you know, not having that thought. But that's, you know, that's difficult to do. And it's still going to subconsciously influence your decisions and your actions, right? I mean, it can't not, unless you're schizophrenic. So this idea that Andrew's talk about of using a passive insight for the party in exactly the same way you would use passive perception when an NPC is trying to sneak up on them makes perfect sense. So if you have an NPC who is trying to deceive the characters, roll deception for that NPC, check it against the character's passive insight. And if the NPC beats it, then they don't know that he's lying to them. And then if the players at some point say, hey, we want to roll insight to see if he's lying, you can handle that a couple ways. You can either say, you don't need the roll. I've already determined based on your passive scores. Although actually now that I say that, I don't think you should do that. That's not a good way to do it because you're kind of giving it away, right? The fact that you checked it against their passive scores kind of tells them that the PC is lying. So I think what I would either do, well, I don't know. I was going to say you could say that you don't need to roll, but that's kind of the, you know, it could make the players feel like you're just being heavy-handed as a GM. So I guess what you could do is you could have them roll and just it doesn't matter what they roll. And you're going to go by the passive check that you already, or your roll against their passive score. So if you rolled your deception and you didn't beat the highest passive score, then probably, you know, they wouldn't even call for the roll because you would have already said, oh, hey, you player with the character with the highest passive insight, you think he might be lying to you, right? But maybe you didn't, maybe you weren't ready to do that yet. So now you could tell that player, oh, hey, you know, you think they're lying. Or, you know, if maybe that player doesn't roll very well, but one of the other players rolls really well on the insight, then, you know, you could tell that player. And otherwise, if you already did your check against their passive scores and you'd already determined that none of them know that he's lying, then it doesn't matter what they roll. Whatever they roll, you just say, oh, it seems like he's telling you the truth. Because versus an NPC that's lying, failing the check is the same from the character's perspective, from the player character's perspective, as it would be succeeding at a check versus a character who's telling the truth, right? All the check tells you is whether or not you think the character is being up and up with you, right? So the character doesn't know the difference between this character is being honest and I succeeded at my insight check versus this character is being dishonest and I failed at my insight check. In both of those scenarios, from the player character's perspective, it's just, I believe what this character is telling me. So that could actually help you with the illusion of the deception and keeping the players as much in the dark as the characters are, because maybe those players roll super high on their insight check and you're still like, no, you think they're telling the truth. And the player's like, wow, I rolled a 19 or a 20. Because again, remember, 20 doesn't mean anything special on ability checks. So they could, you know, then the metagaming is kind of working against them because then they really believe that this character is telling the truth because they rolled really high on the insight check. But in reality, the insight check that they rolled was just smoke and mirrors because whether or not they knew what was going on was determined by your roll you did against their passive insight. And yeah, I think that's totally how you should handle that. And that is the best way to handle it and to keep the players from knowing things that their characters don't know. Right? Because sure, maybe, you know, players will say, oh, I can roleplay that my character doesn't know that I failed the insight check. And maybe you can, but maybe you can't. Right? And either way, it's going to be more fun for the player when they're surprised by the deception when their character finds out, as well as the character being surprised, right? Let the player be surprised too. So Andrew, not only do I think that's a great way to handle it, I think that is the way to handle it. And thank you so much for writing in and pointing that out. And also, just while we're talking about passive checks, I again want to point out that you can apply disadvantage or advantage to passive scores very simply. And if a passive score would have advantage, it's a +5 to their passive score. If it would have disadvantage, it's a -5 to the passive score. So super easy to do. Matt Haddon wrote in about initiative, and this is in relation to, see what episode was that? I believe episode 145 in the combat rules. I talked about how I've started doing initiative because I don't like how initiative breaks up the flow of the game when you call for an initiative roll and we have to stop while everybody rolls initiative. And a lot of times this happens at the beginning of a combat. So one, it disrupts the flow and the pacing because everything stops while you have to tally up everyone's initiative. And at the very beginning of a combat is the worst time to do that. Two, it further reinforces this perception among everyone at the table that we have two separate games here. We have the role-playing game and then the combat game. And that initiative role at the beginning of combat just reinforces that perception of, now we're playing a different game. We're not role-playing anymore. Now we're rolling dice and moving miniatures. Or even if you're using Theater of the Mind, it's still this different mindset, right? So if you can get rid of that initiative role at the beginning of a combat, it's not such a clear, like we're moving from one game to another. It makes it a little easier to keep the role-playing going during your combat and to make it feel like it's all the same experience, whether you're in a tense social situation or you're exploring or you're doing combat. It's all the same game. And the third benefit to not rolling initiative at the beginning of combat is that sometimes rolling initiative will kind of influence the players into thinking about things as a combat when maybe they wouldn't have before. So for instance, you know, I've had this happen in my game where it's a tense social situation and I call for an initiative roll just because I have multiple players wanting to do things at the same time. And it's just a way to organize the table and make sure everybody gets a fair chance to do what they want to do. But just because I ask them to roll for initiative, suddenly in their minds, this turns from a parlay to, oh, we're going to fight. And they think that I, as a GM, am telling them that this is going to be a fight just because I'm asking for an initiative roll. So not rolling initiative at the beginning of a combat or at the beginning of a tense situation avoids all three of those problems. And the way that I do it is I have everybody roll initiative at the very beginning of the session before we even start. I record those numbers. And then the first time I need an initiative roll, I use those numbers. And then at the end of that scene, I do another initiative roll that I will then use in the next scene. And it doesn't matter if it's combat or what it is. So maybe we get together and I'm like, okay, everybody roll initiative. I record what they roll. We play for an hour or so and we get into a tense social situation. And players are, you know, shouting, I do this, I say this. And it's getting a little hectic. And I'm like, okay, we're going to use initiative order now just so that, you know, we can order things. And I'm going to use those numbers that I have. And boom, I've already made a list of everybody in order while the players were doing something. So there's no break at all in the flow. We're just like, okay, it's so-and-so's turn now. And we just go. And then at the end of that scene, when that scene is resolved, in the moments where we're going to, okay, what are the players going to do next? I'm like, oh, hey, everybody give me another initiative roll. And then it's obviously not signaling combat, right? Because we all understand we're rolling this because this scene is over and this is for next time. So it works just as well with a social or any other kind of situation as it does with combat. With combat, you know, you have that moment at the end of combat where maybe they're looting bodies or they're marking off their resources that they used or they're retrieving arrows or they're healing themselves or whatever, or taking a short rest. And so calling for an initiative roll then isn't going to disrupt anything. So that's how I do it. And I really like it. So Matt wrote in and he's got another way that you can handle initiative. So he says, we rolled initiative just once yesterday at the start of the session. I asked everyone to sit in initiative order with the highest sitting on my left and the lowest sitting on my right. We had 6 players in the group yesterday, including 1 newbie. The PCs got into a completely unplanned encounter where they attempted to stealth storm an office of a mid-level gangster. They failed that, then tried to talk their way out of it, failed that too, and a firefight ensued. Needless to say, I think tracking who was going next was so much easier for both me and the players. The gangster won initiative, so I went first and it simply went clockwise around the table. Even delayed or readied actions were much easier to track. And I think the players had an easier time tracking it too. They knew when the person to their right was talking, they were going next. Yeah, and that's a great point, and that's a great benefit of this method. And I think this method is actually given in the DMG when they give different ways that you can handle initiative. And, you know, some people use this and you just do one initiative roll and then everybody sits around the table in initiative order. And that is a definite bonus to this method. Not only do you avoid all the 3 problems that I just talked about with rolling initiative at the beginning of combat, you avoid all those, but also everybody has this very visual reminder of when their turn is next because they know that the person next to them is going, it's my turn next. You know, one way that you can do it if you don't use this method is every time you say, okay, it's so-and-so's turn, you tell the next player and you're on deck. And that's something I used to do a better job of doing that. And I need to remember to do that more because it really does help. You know, if I say, okay, John, it's your turn and Ben, you're on deck. So now Ben knows, okay, I'm next. I need to think about what I'm doing. So that's a way to do it too. So back to Matt's message. He says, thanks for the great and extremely practical advice. We won't be going back to the way the book says. One of my players just mentioned that it was nice to sit next to someone that they normally don't. I also changed the group dynamics somewhat because the table talk changed. And yeah, that's another benefit to this method is, you know, it's so funny. As humans, we're such habitual creatures. And you've probably seen this at your table where the players always tend to sit in the same places, right? And that can subtly affect how things happen at the table. You know, a player might be more likely to have a side conversation with the player sitting right next to them than one across the table, right? And so, this using the players sitting in initiative order is a way that you can kind of change that up every week, assuming they don't always roll the same initiative. Now, I will point out, you know, every method has its drawbacks. For instance, my method, I really don't think my method has many drawbacks. I think it has a lot fewer drawbacks than the normal way that we usually do it in D&D, which is why I do it this way now. But it does have some drawbacks. One of the drawbacks of my method is I have to remember to call for initiative at the end of a scene or at the end of an encounter. And after decades, you know, almost 30 years now of running D&D, I'm very trained in calling for initiative at the beginning of a combat. So I would never forget to ask for an initiative roll at the beginning of a combat or at the beginning of a scene. But I do often forget at the end. So one thing I'll do is I'll put a little post-it note on my DM screen that just says, ask for initiative rolls, you know, and also remembering to do it at the very beginning of the session. Sometimes I forget that too. So, you know, I think that's the only drawback of my method that I've found so far is just remembering to ask for the roll at the beginning of the session and remembering to ask for another roll at the end of every scene in which we used initiative. Now, the downside of this method that Matt's talking about here, where you just roll initiative once and use that for the whole session, is that does open up for more metagaming, you know, and this really depends on your players, because with some groups, this could not be a problem at all. You know, some groups are much more into role-playing and storytelling, and they don't really get into tactics at all, and they certainly don't get into metagaming at all, and with a group like that, it might not be a problem at all. But with a lot of groups where you have at least one player that does think tactically or even tends to metagame or want to min-max or things like that, then having the same initiative order for an entire session, that can be abused by players that are thinking tactically, whether intentionally or not. You know, knowing ahead of time what your initiative order is going to be can lead to some abuse. So that's something to be mindful of and aware of. Now, I think what you could do is I think you could kind of combine this method Matt is talking about with the method that I use and do the separate initiative rolls for every encounter and do them ahead of time like I do it. But when you do the initiative roll, then have people sit in that order. So, you know, I gave that idea to Matt when I wrote back to him and I said, you know, it'd be like D&D musical chairs, right? Especially if you have a lot of encounters, you could be changing chairs quite a few times. So that would be a downside of that if people find that annoying. But that could be a possibility and that might be fun, right? Every time, you know, at the beginning of the session, we all roll initiative, everybody sits in that order. And then after we have our first scene where we use initiative or our first combat, we roll initiative again and then everybody sits in that order. I don't know. I think it could be fun. I might have to try that sometime. Or it could just be a pain in the ass, depending on how comfortable people are in their chairs. And, you know, if you take breaks or not, you know, it could be something where maybe you don't do that every encounter because that might get annoying, but maybe you do it when you take a break, right? So maybe if halfway through the session you take a break, well, then you roll initiative again and have everybody sit in that new order. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can do initiative. When I ran Numenera, I did what's called, I think, team initiative or side-based initiative. And, you know, initiative in Numenera was a little bit different. Instead of like in D&D, when the players are rolling initiative against the monsters or the NPCs, it's basically an opposed roll, right? The players roll, the NPCs roll, and they're all rolling against each other. The highest roll goes first. In Numenera, it'd be more like a roll with a DC. So for this given monster, the initiative DC, say, is 15. So everybody that rolls higher than 15 goes before the monster. Everyone that rolls less than 15 goes after the monster, that kind of thing. And so what I did in Numenera was I just had team-based initiative. And so I would have all the players roll, and as long as one of them hit the DC of the roll, which that's not exactly how it works in Numenera, but for simplicity's sake, we'll just speak of it in D&D terms. As long as one of the players hit the DC of the roll, then all the players got to go first, and then all the monsters went, and then all the players went, and then all the monsters went. Now, that has inherent drawbacks, too, and one of the big ones is, well, okay, there's two big ones. First, kind of like what we were talking about with, like, the stealth checks that Andrew was talking about, same kind of thing. You know, you have four, five, six players all trying to roll and hit a 15. Odds are one of them is going to. And I did find that in Numenera using the system is more often than not, the players went first. The players almost always went first because one of them would always succeed at that roll. And in Numenera, you could actually spend a resource to do better at a roll. Actually, you had a couple different resources you could spend. So if the players really wanted to go first, they almost always did. So that's one drawback. And then the other drawback is that everybody, you know, one side goes and the other ones go. So your players are almost always going first, and they all get to go before any of the bad guys get to go. So it really tips the balance in the player's favor when it comes to any kind of combat, because they're all going to get an action before any of the bad guys get an action. But I was running online, and I found that the degree to which that sped up the game, it was worth it to me. And Numenera isn't as tactical of a game as D&D, I don't think. So it wasn't as big of a deal as it would be in D&D to do that. And the other nice thing was we did something like what Matt is talking about here, where among the PCs, they always went in the same order. And basically, I just decided, okay, among you guys, when we're in initiative, who goes first, who goes second, and so on. And they decided that, and again, it was tactical based on abilities and whatnot, but that was always the same. Not only every combat in a given session, but it was always the same forever unless they decided to change it. So, you know, it got very much like Craig knew he always went after Brian, so it kind of had that same bonus of you always know when your turn is next. Now, another nice thing about online, if you're using like, say, Roll20 has a turn tracker. So hopefully the players are paying attention to that, and they see this visual representation of, oh, I'm next up. You know, so maybe you don't necessarily have to tell them they're on deck, but then sometimes they don't pay attention to that. Now, there are ways that you can do that in person games too. One thing I've seen some of the folks from Wizards do is they'll take a little index card and they fold it in half so that they can hang it on the top of their screen. And on the side facing the player, they put the character's name. On the side facing them, they put their passive perception or any other information about that character they might need. And then when they do initiative, they order those cards on their screen so that they're in initiative order. And then as each player takes their turn, they move their card to the back of the line. So that's another way that you can kind of help your players remember who's next if you don't want to change where people are sitting. So yeah, you know, the way I did it in Numenera with the team initiative, you know, 9 times out of 10, the players went first. It was very weighted in their favor. However, those few times that the players didn't go first, it was really rough because all the NPCs got to go before any of the players did. So I don't really think it evened out because, you know, like I said, the players went first probably 9 out of 10 times. But those times that they didn't go first, it was really dramatic. And like I said, it resolved much more quickly, especially online. So especially since Numenera was less tactical, I thought it worked fine for that game. I wouldn't do that in D&D though, but you might want to. So I guess my point is there's a lot of different ways you can use initiative and ways that you can handle it. And there are some more ideas given in the DMG, which we'll eventually get to when we discuss that in the DMG. So, you know, don't be afraid to try different things. You know, 1 week, try one way, 1 week, try another way until you find the way that really works for you and your group. And every method is going to have pros and cons to it, you know, and it's just finding what matters to your group. Maybe you care more about the pacing and keeping the combats fast and avoiding time where we're wondering who goes next or players are trying to decide what they want to do. Maybe that's much more important to you than any tactical impacts of the players always knowing who's going to go first in a combat or something like that. You know, you just have to decide what works best for your group. And if you're not sure, the best way to find out is just try the different ones and see what you think about it. Ask your players what they think about it and keep trying different things until you find one that everybody really likes. Chris Barrett wrote in with a comment on episode 134, which, among other things, on episode 134, I talked about house rules, and I talked about kind of a screw up I made where I was looking at the free interactions you could make in a round, and I saw that for a free object interaction in a round, you could drink a flagon of ale, and I saw that for a free interaction in a round, you could take a potion out of your backpack. So putting those together, I reasoned that you could drink a potion as a free interaction and not have to spend an action on it or a bonus action or anything else, because I thought, well, surely if you can drink a whole flagon of ale, which is probably like 12 ounces or something, you could easily drink a 1 ounce potion, right? Well, that isn't true, because when you look at potions in the Dungeon Master's Guide, the rules for potions, it very clearly states that drinking a potion is an action. And I actually, I think I tweeted at Jeremy Crawford about this, and he said that, yeah, you know, drinking a potion is an action. And he said, you know, think about it this way. Drinking a potion is the equivalent of casting a spell. And are you comfortable with characters in your game being able to cast a spell without using an action or a bonus action or a reaction? And when he put it to me in those terms, I was like, you know, it was obvious. It was like, no, I would not be comfortable with that. And so it became very clear to me why that rule exists. And, you know, just as a side note here, you know, that's something you really got to pay attention to, whether you're a DM or a player, is, you know, and players really like to do this, but I've seen DMs do it too. And you can get yourself into trouble where you think a little bit too much from a real world, quote, logical perspective, what makes sense logically based on real world experience. And you don't think enough of it from a game perspective. And this potion thing is a perfect example. You know, if you think about it from just a logical real world perspective, and you say, okay, if I can drink 12 ounces of beer and it doesn't take an action to do that, then surely I can drink 1 ounce of potion. And if anything, it should take less time than drinking a beer. And I even pulled in things like beer is carbonated, which makes it harder to drink a lot of it quickly, where a potion I would assume is not carbonated, although it could be, right? Probably would depend on the potion. You know, and logically that makes perfect sense, right? It's like, well, obviously, if you can chug a whole beer and it doesn't count as an action, then you should be able to toss back this 1 ounce potion or even a 2 ounce potion and it shouldn't count as an action, right? But you're forgetting that this is a game. This isn't just a simulation of the real world. As Jeremy Crawford has said before, it's not a physics simulation. It's not a biology simulation. It's a game. And from a game perspective, there's a very big difference between drinking an ale, which has really no mechanical impact, or if it did, it would be, first of all, it'd be GM fiat, and second of all, it would be a negative impact. It wouldn't be a positive one, versus drinking a potion, which, as Jeremy said, is the equivalent of casting a spell, which does have very clear mechanical impacts. Those are two very different things. It's apples and oranges, right? So yeah, from a real world logical perspective, makes perfect sense to say that, oh, if I can drink a flagon of ale, I can drink a potion. But from a game perspective, from a mechanical balance perspective, it doesn't make sense. And I see so many rationalizations for these broken things that people want to do with the spell or with the rules, and they're just using real world logic and they're forgetting about the game aspect, or they're just ignoring the game aspect. So just, you know, whether you're the DM or the player, if you're thinking about a house rule or you're thinking about a variant on a rule or doing something different than what the rules of whatever game you're playing say, don't just think of it from a perspective of what makes sense in the real world and use that as the only justification for what you're doing. You also have to think about, how does this affect the game? How does this work within the mechanics of the game? And how does this compare and relate to similar things in the game? And how are those things handled mechanically? So for instance, you know, maybe I come up with a kind of magic item for my game that's a magic perfume. So instead of drinking a potion, I pull out this bottle of perfume and I spray perfume on myself, and it has some kind of magical effect. So like a potion, that is the equivalent of casting a spell, or let's say I did it that way. You know, there's similar power to potions, so it's like casting a spell on yourself. So the question of would that take an action or not doesn't really have anything to do with how long in the real world does it take to spray perfume on yourself. It has to do with, what is this mechanically doing in the game? It's mechanically the same as casting a spell. Casting a spell in the game always takes some form of action, either action, reaction, bonus action. So spraying the perfume would also take an action because it's magic perfume. And if you say, well, as a free object interaction, you can spray normal perfume on yourself, then yeah, it makes no sense logically or from a real world perspective that just because this potion's magical, it would take longer. But it's not about that. It's about keeping the game in balance with itself and not creating things that can be exploited. So all that preamble aside, let's get to what Chris has to say. He says, I know I'm way behind, but I was listening to episode 134. In the section about house rules, you brought up the free action of draining a flagon of liquid and comparing it to draining a few ounces of a potion. And I was in agreement with you about that home rule until you mentioned the wizard's explanation that posed the question. Do you want someone being able to essentially cast a spell as a free action? Good point. Yeah, and just to clarify, that wasn't my point. That was Jeremy Crawford's point. He told me that on Twitter, and that's why he makes the rules in the game, because he's smart like that. So I said to myself, self, how do I explain that to my metagamers who can get cranky? There's always one or two, right? Yeah, but I don't feel the need to explain stuff to them, but you're welcome to. I could hand wave it and say rules are rules so you abusers can take advantage, which is basically what I would say. But after thinking about it, each potion has to be sealed in some way for carrying it in a backpack and through rough terrain, maybe even underwater. Yeah, that's a good point. I haven't seen any rules for your potion spills or the container breaks or something like that. So presumably they're pretty strong, well-sealed containers. Picking up an open flagon of ale and downing it could certainly take a few seconds, but unsealing a magical potion that has been carefully protected and then draining it could take a bit longer. Yeah, absolutely. So I know it's a small detail, but it helps with my gamers to give some kind of explanation. Thanks for the show. I look forward to listening and finally catching up. Hey, don't worry about it, man. You know, that's the great thing about podcasts. They don't spoil. They don't go rotten. You know, they only get better with age, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, there's no hurry. But yeah, you know, that's definitely a great way to explain it. I think it makes sense. And yeah, you know, if that works for you, awesome. Now, personally, I'd be worried about setting a precedent here that I don't want to set, which is A, I have to explain myself to you as a DM, and B, I have to explain the rules in a way that you agree with as a player, or that fits your worldview or your understanding of physics or whatever. You know, I think telling the players, hey, it's a game balance thing. We're playing a game. This is one of the rules of the game we're playing. I think that's perfectly valid. And, you know, if your players won't accept that, that's a problem with the player, not you. And I don't think as a DM, you should feel like you have to sit here and come up with some explanation that they're going to be happy with. You know, I mean, you're the DM. What you say goes. That's all the explanation that they need. And I mean, maybe this is just a one-time thing, but if this is a thing with a certain player or players that every time you make a ruling they don't agree with, you have to sit there and come up with some explanation that's going to make them happy. I mean, do you really want to deal with that? I wouldn't want to deal with that. You know, I'd be like, hey, the door's right there. If you want to leave, leave. If you want to play this game with us, then play the game with us. But we're not going to sit here and argue about the rules all night. But yeah, you know, I think for me, it's more, I like things that make sense to myself. I like there to be an internal consistency to the world, to the magic, and to the rules, you know. And I'm okay with things like the potion, which where, you know, it doesn't really make, quote, sense, quote, realistically, right? You know, and I'm fine with just it being a game thing because there's so many things in the game that don't really make sense when you think about it, but it's just because it's a game and just the necessary evils of it being a game, that's just the way it is. Like hit points. Hit points don't make any sense when you think about it. The fact that I can be down to one hit point, I'm almost dead, and I sleep for 8 hours and I'm back to full hit points, I'm perfectly fine. But if I've got two levels of exhaustion, it's going to take me 2 days to recover from that. That doesn't make any sense, right? The whole concept of hit points doesn't make sense. The idea that I can be at one hit point and I can run as fast as I normally can, I can climb as high as I can jump as far as I normally can. Like, it doesn't affect my what I can do or my performance in any way, even though I'm one hit point away from death. I'm as strong and as capable as I am at full health. Like, that doesn't make any sense, right? There are a lot of things like that in the game that don't make sense. The whole idea of six second combat rounds and, you know, what you can and can't do in 6 seconds, a lot of that doesn't make sense when you really think about it. A lot of that falls apart if you put it to logic too strongly. So, I mean, that kind of stuff is everywhere in the game. It's everywhere in any role-playing game. I mean, these are games. They're not simulations. So, I mean, it's totally fine to come up with explanations that make sense to you and make sense to your players if you're doing it to increase immersion and increase verisimilitude and things like that. But if it's this kind of adversarial thing where every time you make a ruling the players don't like, you have to, like, convince them or get in this debate and, like, win a debate with them for the ruling to stand or for them not to be pissy about it later, I mean, that's not cool. And personally, me as a GM, I would not put up with that. You know, I would tell the player, look, you either need to accept that I'm the GM and what I say goes, you know, and I'm willing to discuss rules with you. But once I've made a decision, like, we're going on and, you know, it's not cool that you're going to be upset about it the whole session now. Or you need to find another GM, you know, because this is the way I do things and I'm not going to change the way I run my games just for you, you know. So, you know, that's a decision you need to make. But I would be wary of setting a precedent because everything you do, you know, if you're being consistent, which a good GM is consistent, whatever you do, you should be consistent. Everything you do is setting a precedent and you're kind of telling your players, this is the way it is and this is the way it is going to be from now on. So if every time, you know, you're jumping through hoops to explain things to them in a way that they think makes sense, then you're kind of saying that you're always going to do that. And if you want to always do that, then that's great. But if you don't, then you might want to nip it in the bud. So I'm not saying that's what's going on with Chris and or his players. And, you know, I should probably make this caveat more. Because a lot of times people give me feedback and I kind of go off on these tangents because they make me think of things, you know? And I'm not saying that Chris is, like, letting his players walk all over him or that Chris has unreasonable players or anything like that. Like, I don't know anything more about Chris and his situation than what he said in this email. But things that he said, it just brings things to mind. And I've played with a lot of different players. I've played with a lot of different GMs from all over the world. I've kind of seen it all, I think, at this point. And, you know, I'm just trying to help other GMs out there with my experience. So I'm not saying that anything about Chris or his players specifically, but just in general, these are some thoughts that his email brought up to me that I wanted to share with you because I've been walked all over as a DM. I've put up with crap from players that I shouldn't have, especially when I was younger, when I didn't have the self-confidence to stand up for myself. And also when I thought that, like, I had to beg for players. And, you know, I suspect that there's very few people out there that are really in a position where you have to put up with this handful of players and you have to put up with all the crap they give you and you have no recourse. there might be people out there that are truly in those situations, but I think even a lot of people who think they're in that situation, if you really think about it, you have options, right? You can go to your local game store and find more players. You can go wherever you go to meet people and find more players. You can go online and play with people online. You know, I don't think many of us, if any of us, are in a position where you really have to put up with playing with someone that you don't enjoy, you know, that you don't want to. So as a GM, we should be having fun too. And part of having fun is playing with players who respect you, playing with players who aren't going to argue with every little thing you say, and playing with players who have play styles that complement yours and you know, a group of people where we all kind of enjoy the same thing, right? And, you know, we're going to be talking about this soon in a future episode when we talk about the DMG and the different types of players and what different players want out of the game. But not everybody comes to the table wanting the same things, not wanting the same experience. And if you're the kind of GM and you have the kind of players where you really enjoy combat and tactics, and there's a lot of combat and tactics, and then you have a player that does not like that aspect of the game, they're not going to be happy at your table. And if you're trying to bend over backwards to accommodate that one player, you and all the other players at the table who like all the combat and stuff, you're not going to be happy. So a lot of it is just finding a good group where everybody's similar enough in what they enjoy about the game that we can all have the same experience and all equally enjoy that experience. And that's part of it, you know, and part of it is just having grownups at your table, which is not necessarily an age, but it's a mindset, right? You know, I've met 40 plus year old people who are children mentally, and I've met teenagers who are more grown up than adults that I know. You know, it's all a mental thing. But, you know, people who are childish and who are selfish and all they care about is their fun and they're not thinking about the other people at the table, those people aren't fun to play with, and they're going to drag down the experience for everybody, not just the GM, but especially the GM, but the other players too. There's a lot involved to being the GM, and you know, we're going to get more into roles of the GM. And one of the roles I really want to talk about is the GM as manager, you know, managing your players, managing the personalities at your table. And part of that is realizing if or when someone isn't a good fit. You know, it's nothing personal, or maybe it is, but it's like sometimes someone isn't a good fit, and for the good of the group, they need to go. And if that's the case, then better sooner than later. But again, I'm not saying any of this has anything to do with Chris or his players or anybody else that wrote into the show today. These are just my thoughts, just sharing my thoughts with you. And, you know, take what you will. You don't have to agree with me. You know, there are some GMs out there, and sometimes it depends on the game you're running. But there's some GMs out there that just, you know, whatever the players want, the players get. And the GM's just there kind of facilitating the players doing whatever they want to do. And the GM just rolls over. And that might be fine for you and your group, or maybe for the game you're playing. But, you know, might not be. You know, and speaking of that, I just saw a tweet from Jeremy Crawford today on Twitter. He says, and in case you don't know, Jeremy Crawford is the rules lead on the game. He's the sage. When you hear about sage advice, Jeremy's the one writing that. He is the authority on 5th edition rules. But saying that, Jeremy himself on Twitter says, "Reminder, the rules and my rulings are tools for the DM. The DM decides how to use those rules for a particular group of players." Another way to say that is what the player's handbook or the DMG says, what Jeremy Crawford says, whether it's on the podcast or on Sage Advice or on Twitter, does not go above what your DM says. Your DM is on the top. What your DM says goes. Doesn't matter what it says in the book. Doesn't matter what Jeremy Crawford says. Doesn't matter what Chris Perkins or Mike Merle says. All that matters is what your DM says. Now, if you don't like the way your DM runs a game and you don't like the way your DM interprets the rules or your DM's house rules or variant rules, that's fine. Go find another DM. Go find another game to play. But don't keep playing in that game and giving your DM a hard time and arguing with your DM all the time. Now, there are games out there that have different philosophies and different strokes for different folks. But when it comes to D&D, you know, the DM word is law, you know, and you can discuss things with your DM. You can even argue with your DM if your DM's okay with that and it's an appropriate time and place. But at the end of the day, your DM makes a call and the players live by it. That's the way the game works. And if you don't like it, find another DM. But don't make your DM's life miserable. Don't make the other player's life miserable because you're a special snowflake and you think that the rules, whether they're the rules in Sage Advice or the rules in the books or the rules that your DM makes, shouldn't apply to you. So, yeah, enough about that. But I really appreciate, you know, Jeremy Crawford and the other people on the D&D team. They are very consistent in that position, you know, because people tweet them and email them all the time with all kinds of rules questions. And they're always like, you know, this is how the rules work. But at the end of the day, it's up to your DM. And a lot of things, if it's not in the rules, they'll just say it's up to the DM. That's your DM's decision, you know, and that's one of the beautiful things about tabletop RPGs that I like about them, as opposed to say a video game, is that you have this living, thinking, sentient being, the game master, who's calling the shots and who's making the rules and who can make exceptions in specific situations or can change the rules so that they make sense and so that they can create their vision for the game. And I like that. You know, you don't get that in an MMO or, you know, any kind of video game. You know, the rules are what they are. They don't change. They, you know, unless there's a patch or something. But they're not going to change right now because of something that's happening in the game right now, right? So, you know, if you don't like that, if you don't like having a person in charge, then, you know, maybe tabletop RPGs aren't the best thing for you. Maybe you need something more structured where we just obey the rules no matter what, you know, and video games are perfect for that. You don't have any choice but to obey the rules in a video game. But since the very beginning, D&D and other RPGs have been about, you know, the creative power of the DM to use these rules that are given as guidelines to create the experience that they want for their game and to create the experience that is going to have everybody at the table having the most fun and getting the most out of it. So, you know, that's these games working at their best, I think. So undermine that at your peril. I really appreciate all the listeners of the show, and I really, really appreciate all the listeners who help support the show in various ways. And a great way that a lot of you have helped me out and helped new listeners find Game Master's Journey is by leaving reviews on iTunes. So I want to thank C. Lipson from the United States, who recently left me a 5-star review on iTunes. Really appreciate it. He says, I felt the need to write up an iTunes review for the first time so I could say that this podcast, run by Lex, is one of my favorites. I've been listening to Game Master's Journey for about a year and a half now. He does an excellent job explaining DMing and world-building concepts in easy-to-understand terms and regularly incorporates listener feedback into almost all his episodes. As someone who is learning how to DM for the first time last year and continues to learn, I'd highly recommend Lex's podcast. Even for experienced DMs, there are many ideas and stories discussed to get the creative juices going. Keep it up, Lex. Thank you so much. Thank you for that review and those kind words. I really appreciate it. And I'm really happy that this show is helping out newer GMs. That's really the reason I do this show is I love running games and I've been loving running games for a long time. And anything that I can do to help out new GMs and to help players take a shot at being a GM for the first time, I'm happy to do. And it really is great to hear that people are finding the content useful in encouraging them to keep GMing. Great stuff. If you would like to get a hold of me or you'd like to give feedback on the show, suggest a topic, ask a question or anything like that, you can find everything you need to find at my website, starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney. There you can get my email address, Twitter, Google+, Facebook, Pinterest, and YouTube information. You can find the Game Master's Journey voicemail number where you can call and leave me a message. And if your question or your feedback is entertaining or enlightening or both, you may even hear your message on the show. You can also find a link to the Game Master's Journey community where you can share ideas with other listener GMs. And I'm really, really thankful for everybody in the Game Master's Journey community. As I said earlier in the show, it is hands down the best place that I know of to discuss RPGs online. Everybody there is respectful and we have a lot of great discussions and there's no BS. It's great. Finally, at StarWalkerStudios.com, you can learn all the great ways that you can support the show by becoming a patron, making a one-time donation, or by using my Amazon referral link whenever you shop on Amazon. So you can find all this and more at StarWalkerStudios.com. So that is going to wrap it up for episode 147 of Game Master's Journey. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at StarWalkerStudios.com/Game Master's Journey.